Okay, the topic of this mini lecture is olfaction and gustation. Most of the material here has been prepared by Bronwyn Cribb, including many really attractive electron micrographs and photographs, and I'm David Merritt. Okay, olfaction and gustation are just two of the many types of sensory modalities that insects can detect. Obvious other ones are vision and touch, which we'll talk about in another mini lecture. But first, olfaction, the sense of smell. Now, you have to sort of discard your preconceptions about our senses of human touch, taste, smell, etc. when you think about insects, because they're quite different. Now, insects' olfaction is sensed through structures on the antennae, primarily. So the antennae of most insects are absolutely covered with olfactory receptors, single sense organs or sensilla. But they also have them on different locations associated with the mouth parts. There are the palps, they can be labial palps or maxillary palps, frequently have olfactory receptors on them. Looking at gustation, it's also known as contact chemoreception, which just that's the sense of taste. That's designed for detecting large molecules that don't travel through the air well, so that's comparing them with olfactory sense organs. Olfactory sense organs have to detect very low concentration volatile chemicals, whereas the gustatory sense needs to detect larger molecules that are usually in solution, so they touch them with the receptor before they can detect them. They're concentrated on the mouth parts, as you would expect. For example, our taste receptors are found only in our mouth. But in insects, they're on the appendages around the mouth. But also, they're highly concentrated on in other places, such as on the tarsi, on the legs, even on the wings, and on the ovipositor, especially in insects that have a long ovipositor that can reach places where they can't reach with their, for example, their mouth parts. They'll frequently have taste receptors on those, on the ovipositor. Now, this is a diagram from Volker Hartenstein's book, just to show the locations of many different receptor types. The macrochaetes and the microchaetes are blue coloured. Well, they're the tactile receptors, which we'll cover later. So basically, most of the insect's body is covered by hairs that are able to detect touch. But if you look at the antennae on this fly, Drosophila, you can see that there's a concentration of olfactory receptors on the antennae there. And also on the mouth parts, there are some contact chemoreceptors. On the legs, the tip of the tarsus of the first pair of legs here is shown, but they're also found on the second and third pairs of legs. And note that along the wings, there's a line of contact chemoreceptors or gustatory receptors along the wings of flies. It's not exactly known why they happen to be concentrated there. Okay, the unit of smell and of taste and of touch is the sensillum. And it's important that you learn how to use this word properly. It's a Latin word that you're probably not mostly familiar with. Sensillum is singular and sensilla is plural. Now, people who work in different areas tend to use different names for sense organs, so we'll go on to talk a bit about different types of sense organs. But you'll find that in the Drosophila world, where Drosophila is the genetic model organism, the fruit fly, frequently the term sensillum is not used. They're usually just called sense organs. Now, the sense organ, or the sensillum, is the developmental unit and functional unit of touch and taste. And in the earlier lecture when we talked about integument, I made the point that there are a modification of the integumentary or epidermal cells. One cell becomes fated to give rise to the rest of the cells that become the sense organ. You can see that division on the right hand side here shows a cell that's been given a name P1 divides once to give two cells. There are additional divisions. One of those progeny cells gives rise to the shaft and socket, which are the equivalent of the trichogen and ptormogen cells. They secrete the shaft and the socket and then pull away from that cuticular structure and wrap a lumen. And there's a sheath cell, which is also called the thecogen cell. You'll see the term thecogen later on. A ciliated neuron, which is shown in grey, that's a single neuron with its dendrite going to the base of the hair and an axon going to the central nervous system. There's also a glial cell shown here, which is in fact can in some sense organs is a can not be a glia, which is a wrapping cell, but it can actually be another type of neuron. So these lineages are, while fairly simple in that there's only a couple of divisions, the types of cells that they give rise to is very diverse, and it's a whole area of study on its own that we might look at in more detail later when we look at developmental mechanisms. So a sense organ is multi-celled, made up of multiple units, but the external structures that transduce the external stimulus, allow the molecules to get to touch the dendrite, those structures are secreted by these cells during development. The cuticular structures are secreted. Now this is an olfactory sensilla on the honeybee antennae. You can see that there are many different types of sensilla here. One of the most interesting ones here is those, there are flat plates. They're called placodia, sensilla placodia. Now, despite the fact that we're looking at very high magnification with the scanning electron microscope here, we can't see pores there, but there are many very fine pores around the edges of each of those plates. And those pores are where the volatile stimulus is transmitted through to the sensory dendrite, and we'll see how that's done in detail later. But you'll notice that there are other structures as well. You can see that there are a number of hollow holes in the cuticle there. Well, they actually indicate a pit. So there's a cuticular cavity in underneath there, and within that cavity is a little peg sitting on its own. Now, why this is very common in olfactory sensilla, that they're sunken in pits and almost blocked off from the outside. It's possible that that may be due to the fact that the stimulus can be, what would you call it, attenuated, that it would, that there is a little time needed for an outside odor to make its way into that internal pit and stimulate the sense organs. So it might be a way of modulating the rate of stimulation of those sense organs, or it could even just be a way of protecting the sense organs if they're quite delicate. There are also a lot of very short hairs. I'm not sure whether they're actually olfactory receptors or they might be touch receptors. I'd have to go and look that one up. And here we've just zoomed in on one of those sensilla placodia, some of the pits, and you can see there are some very small little domes there. Not sure exactly what type of sense organ they are. Frequently, you can't tell definitively what type of sense organ you're looking at under the scanning electron microscope. You have to cut sections and look with the transmission electron microscope. Once you cut sections, you can see the nature of the dendrites inside and its relationship to the cuticle, not visible from the outside, and then you can make inferences about what the function of the sense organ is. Okay, some of the terminology for sense organs is quite complex, and usually using Latin terminology that describes the shape of the actual sensillum. You can see sensilla cheetica, they're either stout or spine-shaped ceti, usually for touch, sometimes for chemoreception. Trichoid sensilla, trichoid means head, hair-shaped, tapering hair-like structures, olfaction or gustation. There are basiconic, which means pegs, styloconic, which is a cone inserted atop a larger cone-like structure. They're usually gustatory. Capitate, meaning club-shaped. Coelaconic, they're sunk in pits. Ampelacial, they're pegs sunk in deep flask-like pits. Placoid sensilla, we've looked at already. And microtrichia, tiny solid hairs. They don't have a sense organ, a sensory neuron associated with them, so they're just secreted unicellular structures. They're not a sense organ per se. While their function isn't specifically known, it's possible and actually quite likely that they have a function in protecting the cuticle from water saturation. If you refer back to the section on some of the integumentary structures, you'll see some examples of that. Okay, this is a really a stunning electron micrograph of a biting midge. You can see the large eyes. You can see the antennae. Note that the basal segment of the antennae is very swollen. That's because there are Johnston's organs there. They're quarter-tonal organs that detect vibration of the antenna. We'll talk about those in another lecture. The mouth parts. This is a biting midge. It draws blood, and you can see that the mouth parts have these serrated little saw-like structures, plus there are lapping components there for lapping up the blood. But what we're interested in here are the palps. Now, if you look closely, you can see where we've circled some structures. It's just a regular segment of the palps. Seems to have this weird concentration of sense organs. When you zoom in on them, you can see that they're a mass of capitate sensilla. Their function is either sensing carbon dioxide or perhaps sensing temperature or high humidity. So there's a cluster of these sense organs on the segments of the maxillary palps. Okay, let's look at the structure of olfactory sensilla. This internal structure has been reconstructed from transmission electron microscopy, and a definitive characteristic of olfactory sensilla is that the dendrites are branched. So if you remember from the earlier diagram, a single nerve cell body is present underneath the sense organ, an axon goes to the CNS, a dendrite, which is just a unipolar or a single dendrite, goes up into the sense organ. But in olfactory sensilla, that dendrite branches extensively as it goes into the sense organ proper, as it goes up into the hollow internal part of the sense organ. That's obviously a way of increasing the surface area of the sensory neuron so that the dendrites can be exposed to more chemicals. If you think about volatiles and gases, they're present in quite low concentrations in the atmosphere, so the insects have to develop a way of becoming sensitive to these low concentrations. They have many very fine pores in the walls. Often they're very difficult to see, even with high-powered scanning electron microscopy. Their waxy pore tubules probably carry the odors into the sensillum and onto the sensory dendrite. You can see that the structures have been named: the pore tubule, the pore kettle, and the pore itself. Note some of the other structures there, which are the central lumen. It's a fluid-filled lumen, so the inside of the hair is filled with the fluid. So you could imagine that the insect could be exposed to desiccation, sorry, or loss of fluid through evaporation through these tiny pores. And probably the structure of these pores is a balance between allowing contact to the outside and preventing loss of fluid through that through opening up the internal parts of the body to the external environment. Notice also that there's a dendrite sheath surrounding the neurons basally. So this is the characteristics: multiple pores in the walls of olfactory sensilla and branched dendrites. There are different types of olfactory sensilla, and this one shown here has grooves along the length of the sensillum. So we've cut a cross section, and you can see that the grooves have been cut, so it looks like a crown almost in cross section. The pores open within the grooves, and there's often an extended pore channel going from the outside into where the dendrites are. So there's quite a thickness of cuticle between the actual dendrites and the external environment. But the pore channels and the pores have different structures as to they did in the type that I showed you just in the previous slide. Gustatory sensilla are most frequently just long hair-shaped sense organs. Frequently the tip is not sharp, but it's rather blunt because there's only a single pore at the tip. And another diagnostic characteristic is that they have unbranched dendrites within the sensillum. So this photograph here, or scanning electron micrograph, is a styloconic sensillum on the proboscis of a moth. You can see a little peg on a large larger cone-like structure, so that's why it's called styloconic sensillum. It's the peg at the tip that would be the taste receptor. Some of those sense organs you can see on the very sculptured surface are probably also gustatory receptors. So most often gustatory receptors have that sort of hair-like appearance with a blunt tip where the pore opens to the outside. Okay, once again a reconstruction of the internals of a gustatory sensillum, single pore at the tip of the hair, unbranched dendrites. And you can see that there's another dendrite, the dendrites are shown pink here, that terminates at the base of the hair. Very frequently where you have a gustatory sensillum, that they're what they're called multimodal, in that they have a number of gustatory neurons, neurons that have a single unbranched dendrite opening towards the tip at the pore. But they also have a mechanoreceptive dendrite. That's a dendrite that terminates right on the socket. When the hair is moved, it squeezes the tip of that dendrite and causes it to fire off. So it's a combination touch receptor, taste receptor. Excuse me. So it's very common to have touch and taste combined in a single sense organ. So one of the neurons is labeled as the mechanoreceptor or touch receptor. The others are labeled as different types of gustatory receptors. Okay, let's zoom in on the structure of the sensory neuron. The cell body is shown in pink, and you'll see that there's a ciliary region associated with each sensory neuron. That's another diagnostic characteristic of olfactory and gustatory receptors, that they have a single ciliated neuron. In olfactory receptors, that ciliated component it goes on to branch towards the tip. If you cut a section through that ciliated region and looked at it with a transmission electron microscope, it looks very much like a flagellum in cross section. And that's even been used by some to suggest that the way these sense organs work is that they were derived from flagella or motile cilia. And that's probably the case, actually, that evolutionarily they've changed their function so radically that they're no longer active or motile, but they've put receptors into the membrane and they've become sensory instead. So there's this long evolutionary trend you can follow to look at sensory structures in the nervous system, and there's some relatedness right through the animal kingdom. The cells that are often called accessory cells, I mentioned to you earlier they're related to each other by lineage. You can see their relationship here. The thecogen, also known as sheath cell, it wraps the neuron and it secretes that black colored dendritic sheath around the dendrites. The trichogen cell secretes the hair shaft, and the tormogen cell secretes the socket. So these cells have this developmental role in secreting the cuticle. For example, to secrete the hair shaft, the trichogen cell sends out a long process, and then that process starts to secrete cuticle, but at the same time it's withdrawing, so it sort of leaves a mold of itself, and it withdraws further once the hair is completed and wraps around this lumen around the neurons, and it has many microvilli on the surface. That indicates there's some active secretion going on from these cells into that lumen. It's probably creating the appropriate ionic environment for these nerve cells to fire off their action potentials. Okay, there's another class called humidity receptors or hygroreceptors. They're quite rare and not very well known. But where people have cut sections of antennae, they've found these unusual structures, and in just a few cases they've been able to confirm that they respond to humidity. They're peg-like, they don't have external pores, and it seems that the humidity is detected or gathered from the environment through perhaps expansion of the cuticle or transmission of absorbed water into the dendrites. The way they function is not very well known at all. And in this particular example, there's a thermoreceptor, very often sunken a little below the sensillum itself, and very often has a layered and highly branched dendrite associated with the hygroreceptor. So insects are capable of detecting humidity and temperature as well using sensilla. But we won't go into any more detail because there's not a lot known about them. So let's zoom in on how olfactory sensilla work. You can see that outside there are single molecules shown as an oval. They are probably absorbed into the wax layer, transmitted through a pore into the pore kettle, then along the pore tubule into the sensillum lymph, which is the fluid surrounding the dendrites. There, these crescent-shaped structures are what are called odorant binding proteins, OBPs. Apparently, they bind to these molecules now in solution and transmit them to the receptor membrane where a dendritic receptor is present. Now, they're transmembrane proteins. They're called gustatory receptor molecules that sit in the dendrite there, and they are what gives each dendrite or each neuron its specificity, because there are only particular types of gustatory receptor molecules present in each sensory neuron. Now, what happens when these dendritic receptors are activated is that they cause depolarization of the dendrite. And if there are sufficient of them, if there's a threshold is reached, enough depolarization, then a receptor potential is generated, and that potential can be transmitted down the dendrite to the area of the nerve cell body where action potentials are formed. So a graded stimulus is changed into an action potential. So when a sense organ is stimulated, usually there's a volley of action potentials, very high frequency electrical signals running down the axon into the central nervous system. And it's there that the CNS interprets that information or integrates the sensory information. Before we look at anything more about sensillum function, we'll just look at the numbers of sense organs. When you look at the diversity of insects, there's incredible variety of sensory structures and different numbers of sense organs. Hemimetabolous insects such as grasshoppers have been comprehensively worked on. And what was discovered some time ago is that the numbers of sense organs is not predetermined, that there's some variability in grasshoppers in any case. When they're given a diet that's bland, plain, and not diverse at all, then those insects produce a lower number of sense organs at each molt than insects that are given a more diverse diet. So if you look at the graph here, that the sensillum number in insects with that have been fed over the last two stadia before the adult, fed on a mixed diet, which is more diverse than a plain diet, have, say, on average 410 or so gustatory receptors on the maxillary palps, compared to about 340 on an insect on a very plain diet. So that's quite a radical increase in sense organ numbers associated with what the animal has experienced. Now, this is something that it's a bit hard to come to terms with insects, because most of the structures on the insect's body are predetermined, that there are a certain number of sense organs and there's little variability between individuals, especially for the tactile receptors. But in the case of these gustatory receptors, where it has been examined closely, there is an experience-dependent change in the receptor numbers. And it's really enigmatic and totally unknown as to how this experience of diet can be reflected back into the development of new sense organs at each molt, so that a more diverse diet produces more sense organs at each molt. It's quite an interesting area, but very difficult to study. So this is just one example on the maxillary chemosensilla, but it's apparent that olfactory sensilla, the same thing happens, that if a more diverse olfactory environment produces more sensilla. This is the case for the grasshoppers at least, but it might be the case that in the holometabolous insects, that the numbers of sense organs, including gustatory sensors, is more genetically determined rather than experience determined. But that's yet to be followed up on. Okay, to find out the function of insect sense organs, we need to go back to some techniques called electrophysiology. Now, electrophysiology is recording the electrical activity of sense organs. Now, in the case of the taste receptors, a clever method of recording their electrical activity is shown here diagrammatically, that a very fine glass electrode was filled with a stimulus solution. And using a micromanipulator and having an insect tightly bound under a microscope, you can place this glass electrode, say with a sugar solution in it, over the top of one of these gustatory hairs, and now the pore is right at the tip. If you have another electrode in the body, then you can record the action potentials as well as the receptor potential generated by exposing the sense organ to the sugar solution. And in fact, a trick like this was used to show that the pore was actually at the tip of the sense organ, because a sugar droplet was placed on the taste hairs of a butterfly or a moth, and moved progressively upward, and as soon as it touched the tip of the hair, the insect showed a proboscis extension reflex, so that was used to show that the stimulus enters the sense organ through a pore at the tip. So by using this electrophysiological technique, you can record the action potential shown in the right hand side, number 3 there. And different neurons respond to different stimuli, and in some cases the size of the action potential and its shape can be used to discriminate which of the neurons is firing. The receptor potential is shown above in box 2. So the receptor potential is graded, whereas the action potential generated by the neuron running along the axon is a series of action potentials, and that's what's generally detected with this electrophysiological technique. So this electrophysiological approach has been used to figure out what substances insects can taste. They have many different sense organs, but one of the obvious questions is, does each sensory neuron respond uniquely to different molecules, or are there several classes of sense organs? It's turned out that there are multiple classes of sensory receptors depending on what gustatory receptor molecules are present in those neurons. Caterpillars are interesting because, as I mentioned before, grasshoppers have very many gustatory receptors, and that's variable depending on what their experience is, whereas caterpillars, which are holometabolous insects, have a very small number of gustatory sensilla. They have enough that they're very efficient feeders. But perhaps part of the reason that they have a reduced array of sensilla is that the female tends to deposit eggs on an appropriate host plant, so the larva doesn't have to make many choices. There are 8 receptor neurons in 3 sensilla on each side of the body, so that's very low numbers. When we look at, say, a fly, there are in the order of thousands of gustatory receptors. Olfactory receptors on the antennae, there are thousands, and maybe hundreds of gustatory receptors on the mouth parts. Electrophysiological analysis by Schoenhaven and others showed that some are sensitive to sugars, the sweet characteristics of host plants. Others are very sensitive to deterrents. Deterrents are chemicals. You're probably all aware of the arms race that's gone on between plants and insects. Plants are some of the bitter and compounds that plants have evolved solely as feeding deterrents for insects and perhaps for vertebrates, but there are many that we think are only detectable by insects. So there's been an ongoing arms race between insects and plants. Plants can produce toxic chemicals and feeding deterrents. Some insects have been clever, and what the plants have evolved as deterrents, the insects have actually been able to withstand those chemicals, and then they've become attractants for those insects. There are some receptors that are sensitive to amino acids. And so extensive electrophysiology was done on the caterpillars because they only have a small number of sensilla. And if you measure the feeding intensity, and that's the correlated with the amount of fecal pellets that are produced, it can be seen that there's a bias towards the input from deterrent cells. So if the deterrent input is high, then they feed far less than they do when it's low. And the deterrent cells have a stronger influence on the final amount of feeding than, say, the sugar receptors or amino acid receptors do. So insects' capability of picking up deterrent molecules is very important to them, and it has a major impact on deciding how much they feed and what they feed upon. Just on the last slide, we'll just look at Sensillum sensitivity in relation to the diet that the insect has been exposed to. Another mini lecture will cover insect diet in a lot more detail, but this background on the taste receptors is essential to understanding that. So here we'll just look at insects that have been, these experiments have been done on both grasshoppers and caterpillars, and they can be restricted artificially to a high protein diet with low carbohydrate, or a high carbohydrate diet with no protein. Now, then you can give those animals that have been put into either a high protein or a high carbohydrate diet a choice. And what's been found is that they choose the food that they've been deprived of. A high protein diet insect would choose carbohydrate diet subsequently, and vice versa. And part of the way that it appears that they're making that choice is that the mouth part, the chemoreceptors, the gustatory receptors, they increase their responsiveness to a component of the diet that they're missing. So as the sugar and amino acids levels drop in the hemolymph, they become more sensitive to them in the diet. So the graph shows in black insects fed on a high protein diet, and in white those fed on a high carbohydrate diet. If we look at the high carbohydrate diet, their response to sucrose is low, but their response to amino acids, the components of protein, is high. Whereas those fed on a high protein diet, their response to sucrose, which is missing in their diet, is high, and the response to amino acids, which they've had plenty of, is low. And this response is based on the number of action potentials per second produced in those sense organs. So there's some feedback mechanism from diet, which has to enter the insect's body through the gut and be assimilated, and that feeds back to the sensitivity of the receptors. Now, the mechanism of this feedback is not very well known. It doesn't appear to be direct neural feedback, because there are very few neurons that are actually projecting onto sense organs internally. All the sense organs are sending information to the CNS. So it's probably something due to hemolymph. Something in the hemolymph determines how sensitive the sense organs are. And when people have studied different aspects of the sensitivity of insects to components of the diet, it's very complex. They have a very high regulatory capability, but we don't know how they do it. So insects that are satiated, they're full, their receptors aren't very responsive, whereas those that are hungry seem to be more responsive. There's also been shown that there's circadian rhythms in sensitivity of sense organs. Olfactory sensilla are more sensitive at certain times of the 24-hour rhythm of the 24-hour cycle. So there's quite a lot of feedback onto on the sensitivity of sense organs, and it's an area that's ripe for working in the future. Okay, I'll stop there.